Listen up, ladies and gentlemen. Our fugitive has been on the run for 90 minutes. Average foot speed over uneven ground, barring injury, is 4 miles an hour. That gives us a radius of 6 miles. What I want out of each and every one of you is a hard target search of every gas station, residence, warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area. Checkpoints go up at 15 miles. Fugitive's name is Dr. Richard Kimball. Go get him.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's The Fugitive Movie Retrospective Series.
I didn't kill my wife!
I don't care!
Hosted by Brock.
Is he as smart as you are?
Smarter.
Stuart.
When I die, I want to come back just like you.
No, you mean happy and handsome?
And Arnie.
This guy likes his toys.
But be warned, this episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and mildly objectionable language.
What the hell was that?
We hope you enjoy the show.
All right, guys, talk to me. What do we got here?
Today we're talking about The Fugitive, starring Harrison Ford, Tommy Lee Jones, Celia Ward, Joe Pantoliano, Andreas Katsoulis, Yaron Krabbe, directed by Andrew Davis. This is your hinky podcast host, Brock.
And Stuart.
This is the big dog of Now Playing, Arnie.
Woof, woof, woof.
Gentlemen, The Fugitive. We are on the run with Harrison Ford as we prepare for our Indiana Jones series to come back. And I gotta tell you guys, The Fugitive, it's one of those movies that is in every conversation when you talk about Harrison Ford. It comes up instantaneously after Blade Runner and Star Wars and Indiana Jones. The Fugitive is right there.
It is?
Yeah, it is. I can't believe it took us this long to get to this movie.
I would put it this way. I feel like it's his last respected hit, and afterwards he became a different actor.
I completely agree with you on that. I think after this movie, he had Clear and Present Danger, which you guys have reviewed, and he had Air Force One, which we have not got around to, which was a big hit, which I did not like. But I always said for years that this is his last great movie. And I'm a huge Harrison Ford fan. I mean, everyone who's our age is a Harrison Ford fan, right? Because we all grew up with this guy. But this is, in my opinion, his last great movie.
And this is the 30th anniversary. This movie came out in summer 1993. Good time to bring it back. It just so happens Harrison Ford is still a big star and got a movie coming out this week. Yeah, it seemed right to program The Fugitive this week and its sequel next week.
Yeah. So, guys, did you see The Fugitive in the theater when it came out in 1993?
I did. Not that I wanted to. I gotta say, I wasn't excited for this movie one iota. I may be a Harrison Ford fan, but I didn't go see Regarding Henry in theaters either, or Presumed Innocence, and I like Presumed Innocence a lot more than I like this movie. So I didn't see all Harrison Ford films in theaters. This one just looked like a generic TV show turned movie that didn't interest me. It wasn't until it had been out probably a month or so, and everybody kept talking about how great this movie was, that I finally had one night where I wasn't working. I was working two jobs the summer of 1993, so I was pretty busy. And I finally had a night free, and I decided I'd go see The Fugitive. And I walked out, and I remember thinking, it's fine. What's everybody raving about, you know? It was like the pie at the end of Revenge of the Nerds. Why is everybody in line for this pie? It's just fine. And so I thought it was good enough, and I haven't seen it since.
So you're saying there's no naked girl at the end of this movie, like there's a naked girl on the bottom of the pie pan in Revenge of the Nerds. Okay. Okay. That's what you're saying. That was a nice analogy there, Arnie. Stuart, what about you? Did you see it in the theater?
I did see it. I'd started film school, and it was, my tastes were changing, but I did go to a few movies that summer that were Hollywood oriented. And yeah, like Arnie, I remember feeling like it was solid. I don't remember much about it. And so, yeah, I haven't seen it in the 30 years since, and I didn't see the sequel. So it was, yes, a big hit. Worth pointing out, this thing came out same summer as Jurassic Park and a lot of other hits. Clint Eastwood had an adult thriller that had just come out a couple weeks before, In the Line of Fire, but this one got bigger. And as Arnie pointed out, this one was on the trend of, let's take an old TV show and turn it into a movie. I didn't really know the show, so there wasn't any real reason to be excited about a one-armed man.
Yeah, so my parents, when this movie came out and I told them I want to go see it because it's Harrison Ford and it's an action thriller and I love Harrison Ford, I was there opening weekend with my then girlfriend, and we had one of the biggest epic fights we ever had, and I'll tell you when again later on. But this movie, my parents were like, oh, it's based on a TV show, which I never heard of. But apparently it was a pretty big deal in the 1960s. It ran for 120 episodes, and it became a bit of a cult classic in that the last two episodes, the two-part finale, is still one of the most watched television programs in history. I think the last time I checked, it was number three. MASH was number one, and I can't remember what number two was. Might be Seinfeld. But the point is, it's still, and it never will be repeated, people wanted to see if Kimball is going to find the one-armed man, and is he going to be exonerated.
Unbelievable, because I hadn't heard of the TV series before this movie either. I'd heard of MASH, so that you're telling me this was such a phenomenon, and it's not like I hadn't watched Star Trek and Lost in Space and other 50s, 60s TV shows, so that this one completely missed my radar for nearly 20 years until this movie came out. I was almost 20 years old. As shocking.
Well, you know, the problem with this show, so shows like this one, if you haven't seen this show, it's more like for our generation, if you think The Incredible Hulk or The A-Team, in the 90s it was Quantum Leap, that it was like two main characters, and every week it's a different place, different time, different places, etc. That kind of anthology show, because he's on the run. So he has to go to a different town, assume a different identity, and then, of course, Gerard tracks him down and he has to move on, or he gets too involved with these people's personal lives and the cops get involved, and instead of leaping out like Sam Beckett, he just moves on. So, like, The Incredible Hulk TV show is a very good kind of idea, and without this show, those shows would not exist. And about this time, Arnie, you and Stuart, you both mentioned the only movies from TV shows that I can remember were Dragnet and The Untouchables. They both came out in 1987. And after this, this one is very successful and one of the biggest hits based on TV shows. But obviously, Mission Impossible is still the most successful franchise ever based on a TV show, right? And in the 90s, there were countless ones that we didn't even need. Like Beverly Hillbillies, I think, came out right after this one. And tons of bad TV show movies.
We ain't doing that retrospective. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There are so many frighteningly awful adaptations. I don't even like nostalgia TV. And I did go back. I watched the pilot for this and that highly rated last episode and yawn. Boy, yeah. I don't know what was going on in the 60s that would make that show exciting. My problem was I really didn't like David Janssen. Like the guy that was on the run, zero charisma. Who cares?
Yeah, I did the same thing. I watched the first episode, which didn't even start with, it gave you like a Richard Kimball escapes from prison thing, and then It goes right into a story, and then it was Brian Keith, too, in the first episode, which was interesting. And then I watched the eighth or ninth episode, which actually talks about his relationship with his wife, and you see the murder, etc., with the one-armed man. And then I watched a couple of random episodes in, like, season three, and then I watched a two-part finale. And I agree with Stuart, it's pretty hard to watch. And I think, much like The Incredible Hulk or Quantum Leap, in reruns, it's hard to get in there and watch it and get invested. I loved Quantum Leap when it was on TV in the 90s, but if I can't watch it now in reruns. It's something about that show that doesn't really work, even for binge watching. It's just the show is slower paced. It's very much like a play. It's like two sets the whole time. It's a really challenging show. But back then in the 60s, I think also I might be misrepresenting how big the show was. The show was on the air for 4 years, but the finale was such a phenomenon because everyone was familiar with the show, but they had no idea if he's going to get away with this and if he's going to find the guy. It's been one of those pursuits. And so the show was losing its audience and they had to end it. So it became a thing. And that's all I'm trying to say about that.
Yeah. I mean, how can you sustain a murder mystery for 4 years? I mean, Right. Like that. Yes. At a certain point, if you're not going to tell me, screw you. And yeah, if each week all you're doing is going to like a pig farm and helping somebody out that's got, you know, marital troubles. Okay. Then we're really not getting answers on who killed your wife.
Right. So also a modern day version of a show like this would be Poker Face. I know Stuart and I like that show. Check that one out if you haven't done it. Each week's different thing. She moves on to a different town. So this show being so successful, they tried to reboot this in the 80s and it was in development hell. I read up on this. They had 25 drafts of the script. 9 writers did it. And they finally, when Andrew Davis did Under Siege, the producer went to him and said, I got your next movie. And they gave him the script. And when they went to Harrison Ford, he was not the first choice. Their first choice, believe it or not, was Alec Baldwin.
Yeah. And that makes sense.
It makes complete sense because he was off for Hunt for October, but he wasn't interested. And they also didn't know if he could actually carry the movie. Nick Nolte said no because he was too old. That's what he said, even though Ford is, I think, the same age or around there. Kevin Costner or Michael Douglas were also considered.
I mean, Kevin Costner is the biggest star of the 90s. I'm sure he's offered every script. You know, he's offered, yeah, everything at this time. But yes, I'm glad you brought this up because I want to say watching the movie, that was my first thought of this doesn't have to be a Harrison Ford vehicle. That it is obviously the reason why we're covering it now, but this could have been other people in the role, and Alec Baldwin brings, like, you believe that man could kill his wife, right? Yes. Nick Nolte, he definitely killed his wife. I'm just saying some of these actors you mentioned have darker screen personas. They do play people that are, you know, it would create a different impression going into a movie about a man on the run. Is he an innocent man? You put Harrison Ford in it, and yeah, I mean, he's kind of a rascal, but Harrison Ford is a good guy. And I think that that just sort of changes. It gives you a different feel than any of those other actors you mentioned.
Yes, I agree with you completely. And he was concerned that most of his movie would be just running and investigating and he wouldn't have any dialogue. But he was looking for a role like this because it's, would he be the kind of person to murder his wife? Like, because Presumed Innocent, as Arnie mentioned, was in a similar vein, and he would come out with What Lies Beneath many, many years later, which is the same kind of thing, right? Is he capable of murder? So he also really wanted to grow a beard for a role, and then, of course, there was that whole big story about why he grew the beard, and they agreed, you can grow the beard for the beginning, but you have to shave it off, and etc. For Gerard, now, Tommy Lee Jones worked with Andrew Davis in Under Siege. Like, he was the villain of Under Siege, so that's how Andrew Davis found Tommy Lee Jones. But the producers wanted Gene Hackman, John Voight. Those two were the first choices, and you can understand that completely.
Gene Hackman would have rocked it.
Oh my God, he'd been great.
Well, here's the difference. The difference between those two. Yes, all the same, like, version of Salt, right? You cantankerous, like, guy that's going to give you like a lot of attitude as he talks in the walkie. But you can't imagine Gene Hackman running 4 miles. You can't imagine John Voight doing a fist fight. Like, Tommy Lee Jones is physical. You know, he's maybe a little bit younger than those dudes, and he's in shape. I mean, like, he can keep up with any fugitive that he's pursuing. And so I think that's why you'd want Tommy.
And the year before, Gene Hackman won for Unforgiven. And later on in the 90s, he became the second banana to the top star of the die, right? Because Tom Cruise of The Firm, Get Shorty, The Birdcage, one movie after another, Enemy of the State. He was the second billed guy next to a hot star at the moment. And that's how he maintained his career all through the 90s into the 2000s. And this would have fit in right there as well. But I'm glad that they got Tommy Lee Jones for this.
Tommy Lee Jones is glad they got Tommy Lee Jones for it. Because I remember I'd seen this movie. He won an Oscar. And I was like, what the hell? They gave him an Oscar for that movie?
Well, supporting, you know, again, there's a different standard for your supporting. Supporting, you want kind of the scenery chewing, you know, you can be more of a caricature and win an Oscar in the supporting roles. But yes, it is a little of a surprise.
But he beat Ralph Fiennes in Schindler's List. And at the time, I couldn't believe this happened. Like, it was amazing. But then if you think about it, now that I'm older and understand the Oscars more, Schindler's List was winning all sorts of awards that year. The Fugitive was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including 6 for the editors, and I'll go into that in a second. And so this was the award for that movie, right? They gave the big award for Best Supporting Actor to highlight how good this movie was. And Tommy Lee Jones and Harrison Ford are two stars, and they're both good guys. They're antagonists. They're not the villains. They're both heroes of this movie. You don't really see that very much in movies, that you have antagonists, not a villain and a hero.
But would you have known that, again, if you were chasing Alec Baldwin? Again, like, the fact that you have Harrison Ford really signaled to the audience is why it made a big box office. I want to point out this thing opened towards the tail end of the summer after the big guns had come out, but it held the number one spot for like a month, like stayed off a whole lot of, you know, including Wesley Snipes' Rising Sun, you know, who will inherit the franchise next time.
One thing I want to mention before we move on is that even though I said there were 25 drafts and they attracted stars like Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones, they wrote most of this movie on set. They didn't like the way it was written, and they've tried to figure things out as they went. There's a story that Jane Lynch and Harrison Ford wrote their lines right before they did it. It was almost improv. Tommy Lee Jones and his band of minions, all that stuff, it's really fun to watch, and their interactions are great. A lot of that's improvisation, just to get from point A to point B. Obviously, there were scenes in the parade and the city hall, but the dialogue and stuff was a lot of them on the fly, which is, I've heard this story about Harrison Ford in the 90s a lot. I especially heard it about The Devil Zone with Brad Pitt. Both of them wanted different changes the script. I never understood if you're going to sign on for a movie and you agree to watch do this movie that you just decide the day of shooting that I don't like the words. But he's Harrison Ford. He's Brad Pitt. They can, I guess, say that and they change the script that day, I guess. It just seems really strange to me. If you go into a movie, you should probably have a finished script. That's just what I think.
That's certainly not how Hollywood thinks. I mean,
well, I understand that. Yes.
Yes. Everyone believes it's pretty good, but it can be better. And more to the point, it needs to be more about me. So that is why screenwriting, rewriting is always something pervasive. And yeah, I think it's really interesting to note that. I definitely feel like in watching this movie, I mean, I was an adult then, but now, you know, 30 years later, I definitely feel like the fun of the movie is less about the whodunit. Yeah, that's a little confusing to me.
Yeah.
Maybe we can unpack that. But yeah, this thing was nominated for Best Picture and Best Supporting Actor and a lot of technical awards, not up for Best Script. Yes.
Yes.
They were hoping it was all going to hang together. And who knows, what from day to day, who the one-armed man was or why he did it.
But I mean, you just don't watch this film and think Harrison Ford should be best actor at the Oscars for this film. So, and he wasn't nominated, was he?
No.
So that Tommy Lee Jones did walk away with a gold statue for this to this day still boggles my mind.
Again, if you look at the history of supporting wins, they tend to be like funny characters, like people that make you laugh a lot.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes. Obviously, there's Javier Bardem was not a funny character, but...
Yeah, he was.
He was fun to watch. I didn't think he was funny. I think he was really fun to watch, but I disagree on that. But like Kevin Kline had won right before that. But Tommy Lee Jones also had been nominated at least one more time, like JFK right before this, right? So yeah, The Fugitive was a huge hit, and I'm looking forward to unpacking this as you talked about. So Arnie, how about we talk about the night that Helen Kimble died in the plot summary.
Dr. Richard Kimble, a Chicago vascular surgeon played by Harrison Ford, has been wrongfully convicted of murdering his wife. He is sentenced to die. While being transported to an Illinois prison, some inmates stage an escape, causing the prison bus to crash, and Kimble escapes. Now he is the fugitive, out to prove his innocence and find the one-armed man who killed his wife. Hot on Kimble's tail are a group of U.S. Marshals led by Deputy Marshal Samuel Gerard, played by Tommy Lee Jones. The Marshals come close to catching Kimble several times, but Kimble eludes them. He returns to Chicago where he uses his medical and hospital knowledge to track down the one-armed man. He finds that man is Frederick Sykes, head of security at pharmaceutical company Devlin McGregor. Kimble had been trying to torpedo one of Devlin McGregor's new drugs due to liver damage the medicine caused. As such, Kimble's colleague, Dr. Nichols, who stood to make a fortune from the new drug, hired the one-armed man to kill Kimble and cover up the drug's side effects. When Kimble wasn't home, the man killed Kimble's wife for reasons. Gerard, still trailing Kimble, puts together the information Kimble is discovering and, in a climactic chase, Kimble outs Nichols. Gerard arrests both Kimble and Nichols, but Gerard tells Kimble they know he's innocent, and Gerard takes the cuffs off the wrongfully convicted man as credits roll.
And one thing you can say as we get started here, Andrew Davis, we haven't really ever talked about him before, but he's an action director that always put Chicago in his lens. He was just known as someone that, Chuck Norris, you're going to Chicago. Steven Seagal, it's a Chicago movie for you. And when I was in film school, it was always exciting. People really wanted to get on Chain Reaction because he was just known for being a great director and bringing in Chicago talent into the Hollywood system. So yeah, it makes sense we'd start here.
And then they saw that movie and were glad they didn't get put on Chain Reaction. I mean, I've seen Chain Reaction.
A credit is a credit. I mean, you know, we'll talk about it. But yes, Andrew Davis's career after this, maybe not living up to the promise. But yeah, this is the pinnacle for him. Starting in Chicago, the middle of the night, we see the skyline and we see the site of a murder. And a man, it's always the husband, right? Like, if the wife is dead, the mind is trained to think, got to be the husband.
And it usually is, to be fair. I mean, if you follow the news, and when the wife is found dead, usually the husband is the guilty party.
He's usually the first suspect, no question.
Okay, Nancy Grace. I mean, I let's not, again, why don't we let people have their day in court? Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm just saying, for the people who've had their day in court, the husbands are often found guilty.
Maybe statistically that is true, but do you believe Harrison Ford here in the beginning? Now, of course, we're all spoiled because we know this movie, and
yeah,
again, Harrison Ford brings a certain something, but occasionally he had played darker people. Would you have thought, do you remember what you thought? Is it possible for someone to come to this movie and believe that this is about a guilty man that gets out of custody?
No. No, because if you came into this movie and saw the trailer, I think, you know, the trailer had him saying, I didn't kill my wife. And I think we come in knowing that this is a wrongfully convicted man. If you came in completely knowing nothing about this movie, and, you know, it's 30 years old. Maybe some of our listeners did. They saw we're covering a movie called The Fugitive. They put it on. Maybe they didn't know. I'd be interested to hear from them. But I think the way this film was released, and yes, as you mentioned, it's Harrison Ford, no way he's guilty.
But as it starts, one thing I want to point out is we cut back and forth between the cops interrogating Harrison Ford and the actual murder. And at no point do they show us who is attacking Helen. And so I think it leaves room for doubt when Harrison Ford, again, he looks, the beard and all of that, he looks kind of scary.
Yeah, also my big mystery in this opening scene is how did he score Celia Ward? It didn't make any sense to me that these two people were married. It seems like they wouldn't belong together as a couple. Maybe it's a second marriage. They don't really go into that sort of thing, but they seem like they're still in the honeymoon phase and they're, what, in their mid-40s. It seems a little strange how the whole thing is put that they're a very happily married couple versus a long-time married couple. Maybe I'm not saying those two things are mutually exclusive. It just seems that it's a new marriage.
What are you telling us about your marriage, Brock?
Yes, this is True Confessions on The Fugitive. No, I'm just telling you that it just seems a little weird.
But this is where Alec Baldwin would be more helpful because, yes, again, a younger actor, and we don't really know him that well. Like, we know Harrison Ford from the movies. And so what is he capable of? And, you know, I think he made Malice around this time. So, yeah, he really, there's a guy that plays bad guys. So that would have been interesting to play with. But, I mean, maybe it's a fool's game to try and trick the audience on this when, if they know the TV show, certainly if they know the actor, they know what they're in for from the advertising. There's no taking them down into thinking that Kimball's a bad guy.
But I think what Brock's saying, where we see the scenes of them together, they seem far too happily married for this to be a duplicity. You know, I think that we're seeing instantly that this is a couple very much in love, and we see that he gets called away to a surgery and the wife's going to wait up for him, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more. And I think this shows us he's innocent, even if the opening murder doesn't show us a one-armed man.
Yeah, I guess. You know, it's hard to pay attention to Celia Ward. She's essentially a prop. None of the flashbacks will ever tell us anything about her. We will learn that she had more money than him, and that might be the motive. And yeah, we have one scene of them in the car with him answering the car phone. What they're really doing is introducing possible suspects, that at the soiree earlier, we run into the killer and another suspected, you know, person in this whole conspiracy that will unravel. I didn't really pay attention to her, is I guess what I would say.
Well, actually, I didn't pay attention to the suspects at the party. Like, they drop in really early, thanks for the loner right there in that open, one of these opening scenes.
I think that looks guilty. If you have an anonymous character run up and say, thanks for letting me borrow your car keys, I'm like, you did it.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking that at the time and being right. Like, yeah. I remember, like, within minutes feeling like the whodunit, like, had fallen apart.
They dropped it really early, and then they're hoping you forget.
Yes, right, right, of course.
Right, that's really what, yeah, that's really what it is. They drop it so early, they hope you forget. And, you know, the first time I saw it, I was, what, 18, 19 years old. I can't say I did remember that one moment. On rewatching, when I owned it on VHS, and I watched this movie over and over again, yes, I completely caught it then. But, you know, this opening scene is intercut with him being interrogated, with her murder, and it goes on, and the credits go interspersingly, what, every, it's like 20 minutes before the credits are actually done. They do a long time to get this movie set up and get him in prison.
I have the exact opposite. I can't believe he's already off to the slammer 10 minutes in. By 10 minutes, usually, because the 90s were known for their courtroom dramas, I couldn't believe how open and shut this case was. Like, he goes in for questioning, and people are judging him, like, through the two-way mirror instantly. We get a little bit in court of them playing her 911 call, And because she says, Richard, he's trying to kill me, because she can hear her husband coming up the stairs as she's being attacked. But it sounds to the lay ears as Richard is the one trying to kill me. That's enough to get you convicted?
Apparently so. We need the setup of this movie, so we gotta go with it. I'm surprised it's enough to get him the death penalty.
Right!
Right, yeah.
Especially in Illinois. I mean, Illinois is a very liberal state. You gotta do a lot to get the death penalty in Illinois, and they probably never would have actually injected him, because it wasn't too long after this they just put a moratorium on death penalties in Illinois, but...
Yeah, I looked it up too.
I digress on that. I lived in Illinois too long. And so, I... was just shocked. You gotta give him stakes, though, I guess. And that's why the fact that he is going to die means he has nothing to lose when he takes on this chase.
Right. You're not gonna fight this from a jail cell talking to your lawyer. You have to do what he's going to do.
Although, let's face it, again, he's a wealthy doctor. We didn't see the appeals process occur here. I'm not even sure how much time this trial takes. Is it like an open and shut? They try him, you know. I know we have the constitutional right to a speedy trial, but is he tried and convicted in a month?
Yeah, it could be. It could be that quick.
There's no way to know that. Yeah, but I'm guessing no. It seems, and if you know anything about the court system, it's probably at least a year. But yes, it seems the movie just goes fast forward through that part. But you know, it just, a lot of ground is covered in a relatively short amount of time.
And true of the first episode of the series, too. As Brock pointed out, it wasn't like we spent all this time setting it all up. It was like first commercial break, and now you're off to your first town. And like having an adventure that has nothing to do with the murder. So that's kind of what they're doing here. We're like, if this is about the fugitive, it's not about, you know, the wrongful murder of the wife. She is a prop. She is something that just gets things in motion. And it's really about having him break out of his cell. He is being loaded up onto a bus with other convicts, and things go sideways, quite literally.
This is what I knew about the movie coming in. I hadn't had a whole lot of interest in the movie, but on television, there were these making-ofs. Everything was focused on the train scene. And of course, he's on a bus, and I couldn't remember coming back. I'm like, how does a bus get involved with a train? But I remembered that there was going to be a big train crash that involved a lot of money and this, not really special effects. Is it special effects if you really crash a train? Because that's what they did. So.
Yep. They actually, you could still go down to North Carolina and see the train. They never clean up after this, and it's become a tourist attraction.
So Hollywood. Yeah, now it's a tourist attraction, meaning we don't want to pay someone to move it.
We don't want to pay to clean it up. So yes, Arnie is right. They decided miniatures weren't the way to go. They only had one take at it. I read it took like 30 cameras. They tested it out like crazy. They made sure, and I saw some behind the scenes stuff on how they tested it out with logs and blah, blah, blah. And him jumping off the train, I don't want to get too far ahead, that's green screen. 1993, pretty good green screen.
Yes, that's obviously really, really bad green screen.
Well, it was good for the time. Yeah, you got to get your mind back to 30 years ago.
Like, yeah, it's...
it wouldn't cut the mustard now, but, you know, yes, I remember this being really the signature scene that everyone talked about from this movie was, you're not going to believe watching Harrison Ford. You know, if he ran from a boulder 10 years before in Raiders, this one's so much more epic that a derailing train is going to come at him. Because, yes, what happens is basically the bad convicts stage an uprising. They grab a gun. The driver gets shot. The bus is on the tracks. And so Kimball, interestingly enough, has thrown keys to his... They want to release him because he's a doctor. He might actually be able to help the injured guard. And he does the hero work. Again, if you were thinking it was even possible at this point that he was a killer, we see him be self-sacrificing, staying behind and helping a guard out of this bus before it collides with the train. Just tells us that he's good-hearted.
Yeah. And him climbing out of that window is actually him. He did most of his own stunts in this particular scene. It's all great stuff. I love that guy who plays the guard who doesn't, he says, screw this and runs away. We've seen him in a thousand things. I still don't know his name, but he works constantly. And that's like the first one of a lot of people in this movie that, you know, you recognize from a lot of other things.
Yeah, you're talking about Richard Reel. I think that's how you pronounce his name. I know him primarily from Office Space. That's where I always go to. He's Tom in Office Space.
He wasn't in Real Genius?
He was also Deuce Bigelow's dad in Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo.
Of course. Who could forget?
And very recently, he was in season 4 of Barry. So he's all over the place.
Yes. I actually saw him play Santa Claus in one of those kid movies with the dogs talking, and he was Santa Claus. So.
Yeesh. Okay, but he got to be in The Fugitive. Right? What you're telling me is it's hard being an actor. You have to do a lot of degrading things, but occasionally you get in a movie that's nominated for Best Picture.
Occasionally, yeah, without talking dogs or anything, but yes. The scenes, I think, regardless of Arnie's opinion on the green screen for that one moment, I think this train crash is phenomenally awesomely cut and done and beautiful. I love it. I love everything about this.
A few moments, the moment when he jumps from the train. Anytime Harrison Ford is on the screen, actually, and the train is behind him, it looks dodgy as hell. It just does not hold up. I'm sorry, but watching this on the big screen at home, it was oof.
I watched it on my big screen. I have a 65-inch screen here. I was buying it. I enjoyed it. Of course, I am partial to this movie. I do like this movie, but I still think it looks really great. And the way it's cut and the way it's filmed really does work. They've really showed us that, kind of like in Back to the Future, like Crash a Train is kind of fun to watch.
Hey, I love The Empire Strikes Back. That doesn't mean I can't see the boxes around the TIE fighters in the original one. Just because you love a movie doesn't mean it's flawless.
Agreed.
Well, but at the same time, on the other end of that, you have to respect that the movie wasn't made today. And so it's not going to look like the entertainment you get on a weekly basis. Like, this looks good for a 90s action movie. If you can't accept it, I would say skip the 90s, right? This is as good as it was going to be around this time.
Yeah, that's true.
Skip the 90s. It's the best decade I've lived through.
So right after that, and Kimball runs into Coleman, who is another survivor of the crash.
The only other one other than the guards, right? All the prisoners died.
They died on the bus itself. They in the uprising, they were killed attacking the guards.
Right, the one got shot with a shotgun. So he meets Coleman in the forest, and he says, I don't care which way you're going, don't follow me. And they escape separate ways, and Harrison Ford starts running through the forest, and that's when we have Tommy Lee Jones come in.
And was I the only one who, in the back of my mind, was like, why aren't they after Coleman more? I mean, they should not just be after Kimball. They should be after both escaped fugitives. They're going to trick me with that, but like for a good half hour of this movie, I'm thinking to myself, did the other guy just get away?
So you're telling me that after all this time that they're setting up Richard Kimball, you actually care about the other fugitive? And I mean, that's interesting to me because, as you said, they're going to do that later on in the movie. They're going to do a quick little fake out for us, which is fun because just like the Thanks for the Loner earlier in the movie, they're hoping you forget so you can actually have a moment of revelation later on to set up Tommy Lee Jones and how ruthless he can be in pursuit of his fugitives, you know? So I don't think I ever thought about Coleman and gave him a second thought until the fake out scene coming up.
Yeah, let's be clear. The fugitive is Harrison Ford. It's not anyone that gets away from prison. Like, I'm not here for Prison Break. I'm here because, well, again, yes, Harrison Ford is the fugitive, but also the one-armed man is the fugitive. So like, it's one man chasing another man. And now you've introduced a second layer of, yes, Sam Gerard, Tommy Lee Jones in his Oscar-winning role. I get it. Arnie, I'm going to dispute you. I get why people are going to be charmed by him. Because up to this point, the movie's not very amusing. Like, it's entertaining, but it's not funny. But once Sam Gerard walks in, the confidence he displays, the way he can take down local sheriffs who claim that there's no way their fugitive could be alive, this lets you know that he is a worthy adversary for Harrison Ford.
Please do not get me wrong. I love Tommy Lee Jones in this film. I think he's amazing in this film. I just think up against Schindler's List, it's not an award-winning performance. And that's the only thing I'm saying is it boggles my mind that he got picked for the statue. But he is great in this movie. I dare say he is better than Harrison Ford because Harrison Ford isn't given a lot to do in this movie. I mean, he's investigating, but he doesn't have a character arc. He's the same character at the beginning of this film and the end of this film, the I didn't kill my wife guy. Whereas Tommy Lee Jones, his character is going to have an arc, an emotional arc where he's going to start very clearly saying, I don't care if you killed your wife or not. And by the end of the movie, he does care. He has more resonance as a character, I think. I think he's more three-dimensional character than Harrison Ford. And yeah, once he walks on screen, the train crash was great, but we're only 20 minutes into the film. Tommy Lee Jones is walking in, and yeah, the screen lights up. And it doesn't hurt that he's surrounded by just a great cadre of character actors, the most known of whom is Joe Pantoliano. I love him in everything, Joey Pants.
Absolutely.
But everybody else in the crew, too, they're just, you said they're rewriting this and ad-libbing this. It feels like ad-lib. It feels so natural, all the dialogue and the way they're bouncing off each other. And it feels like a real camaraderie among these U.S. Marshals.
Yeah, they have really funny lines like, it's always curious when you see leg irons without legs in them. Or the woman in the group says, do you care to change your bullshit story, sir? All of this stuff, all of these people are fun. You want to be around them. Daniel Roebuck is also a very fun character actor who's in this one. It has a few lines here and there. It's just this troop of U.S. Marshals are a lot of fun to watch. I agree with you. You take them seriously. And of course, they're never afraid to show us that they've worked with each other for a long time and get along great. I agree. This movie starts to really take off once Tommy Lee Jones gets in the picture. No question.
Right. Because, I mean, essentially, it's from this very first scene, Kimball would easily get away were it not for Gerard. Because Gerard is so cunning, we worry that Kimball is not going to find the one-armed man before he's back behind bars.
Right. And perhaps the most famous lines from this movie was in the trailer. It was intercut with Harrison Ford running like it's in the movie, is when Sam Gerard says, a hard target search of every gas station, residence, warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, and doghouse in that area. And it was one of those trailers that lit up the screen. However, it wasn't in the script. It was written by the marketing people who wanted it for the trailer, and they put it in. They loved it so much, they actually kept it for, it's one of those scenes that they were going to make just for the trailer, but in this situation, they actually put it in the movie. And of note, when Harrison Ford was running through the forest, intercut with this, he actually twisted his knee and got very hurt. So later on in the movie, when you see him limping, Harrison Ford is actually limping because he actually hurt himself. We don't see like the character hurting himself. Harrison Ford actually did because of these scenes here in the forest. And that's interesting to think about because, you know, he's Harrison Ford and he's an insurance risk if he goes down. And he's, you know, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, that amazing story that he didn't film most of the movie because he was out with a back injury. He does his own work. And so this scene was notable for two different reasons. That hen house, farmhouse, outhouse thing is one of my favorite lines of the 90s. I think it was brilliant and so much fun. Such a great delivery by Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh, yeah. I quote that line at least once a month. I may not love this movie, but anytime I lose my keys or I lose some tax papers or something, all of a sudden, I am quoting this movie. We're doing a hard target search of every outhouse, henhouse, doghouse. I'm constantly using that speech because I'm constantly losing shit.
And he finishes it off with Dr. Richard Kimball with like a little bit of disdain in his voice, which is also a great, as Stuart mentioned, character thing for this character because he doesn't care that the guy killed Parsons. He's only caring about catching him. And who cares if he's this famous doctor or a rich doctor? He doesn't care. He's on the run. He's my guy. And that's all you need to know about this guy in this one scene. And then, of course, we get so much more. That's just the brilliance of Tommy Lee Jones in this movie.
And this is my favorite part of the movie is Harrison Ford on the run, the chase part of the movie where Tommy Lee Jones is just right behind him. And Harrison Ford has to go into a hospital and he's been wounded. He has to give himself some stitches and he has to go into a patient's room and trim his beard. And I laughed anyway when he steals the patient's breakfast and yes, grabs the juice and everything and takes it with him and is walking around. I mean, this chase stuff is exciting. It's enthralling, and yeah, unfortunately, the movie is going to change after Act 2. Act 2 is pretty much Richard Kimball needs to just get out of the sights of Samuel Gerard.
So your favorite stuff is cat and mouse. That's what you like seeing. And
yeah.
Okay. I get that, but you also recognize you can't do 2 hours of that. It has to change. That it changes in Act 2 is correct. That is what a script should do. But yes, why we like this, why this is the entertaining backbone of this whole movie. And as you say, they haven't even worked out the specifics of who killed Helen because it's not about that. Because what we really want to see is that Kimball gets away. And he may not. What scares us about Gerard is that he's smart. He's cunning. That he, when other people write off Kimball, he is, you know, following his instincts and making sure that he you know, checks everything and is always just right there on his heel.
He steals an ambulance and they chase him into that famous scene at the dam. I think we probably should need to talk about that for a quick moment. It's a very famous scene. He jumps off the dam at the end of it. They film this in a tunnel. Obviously, it's a set, right? They built a set for tunnels and they actually filmed a dummies. I mean, you talk about special effects, Arnie. The one special effects I even noticed back then is when he jumps off the dam, it's clearly a dummy. But Harrison Ford did jump off something into a mattress, obviously. But when you see the long shot, it's they threw like 30 dummies off the thing and edited it together so it looks like but it's clearly a dummy and you have to go with it.
All right, and I didn't notice that.
That's funny you didn't. That's great. So you notice the green screen of him jumping off a train, but you didn't notice an obvious dummy being thrown in the water. That's great. I love it.
Yeah, but it is a good scene. I mean, again, we are still in heavy action here. The chase through the tunnel. Again, I love the U.S. Marshals when they can't find him because he slipped into like a sewer grate to get into those tunnels. And they're like, how the hell did we lose him in a tunnel? And this is where Sam Girard is almost too smart, right? The fact that he sees water going down a drain and goes over, flips it up and realizes a man can get down there. And
well, I mean, I think that he is as smart as Kimball. And that's what they're telling us. Is that every instinct that Kimball has for self-preservation is one that Sam Girard can come to as the hunter. And so, again, you really wouldn't lay odds that Kimball is going to win here. But what's interesting about this moment, it's one of the few scenes where the two actors share the screen. It's kind of like Heat, where like we got two big stars, they're never together. But in this moment, we have Sam looking a little foolish, actually. Girard slips and he drops his gun and Kimball picks it up. And if he were a bad guy, this has to be where the doubt sets in. If he were just a hardened killer, killed his wife, wants to get away at all costs, why wouldn't he blow away his pursuer right there? He had every means to do so. The fact that he won't shoot him and keeps running, yeah, kind of really starts the ball rolling for Act Two for Sam to think maybe that it does matter whether this man killed his wife or not, whether he's chasing an innocent man or a guilty man.
Yeah, this is where you get that little exchange. I didn't kill my wife. I don't care. And then, yeah, Harrison Ford takes this. I love that Sam Girard calls it a Peter Pan off of the dam, which nobody could survive, but it's a Hollywood movie, so we'll go with it. And he just washes up on shore down below. And Girard is, of course, the only one who would know he could actually survive that and keep the hunt going.
Right. Again, this is the second time this has happened. The sheriff from the train accident said no way anyone could have lived. And is that just professional laziness? Or, you know, would you really think that Harrison Ford is just shrapnel underneath the train? It's hard to say. But what it tells me again and again is that Girard is someone to consider formidable, that he is equipped to get to his man. And the tension is, we kind of want both of them to succeed. And the happy ending is that they do, but we worry that Girard will succeed at the expense of Kimball.
There's a moment right here, too, when right before he says, you know, if he gets eaten by a fish, I'll go get a fishing pole and get the fish. He says to the young guy, whose name is Noah, he's like, Noah, what you doing back there? He says, I'm thinking. And like, he's all serious. Like, what are you doing back there? I'm thinking. All right, well, why are you thinking? Get me a cup of coffee and a donut with little sprinkles on top. And like, that little moment of humanity, he wants sprinkles on his donut, really makes you like this guy again. Like, and that's the kind of stuff that when you watch on repeat viewings, that you just eat up more than just the conspiracy and more than Richard Kimball and how he's trying to pursue the murderer. Because the first time you watch her, the first time in a long time, you get into what Kimball's doing and you're getting into Girard. But the rewatchability of this movie for me has been Sam Girard and his team and those little moments that they have. And we're going to go right into another one when they hunt down another fugitive.
Well, this is where it gets sticky, because up to this point, I agree. Sprinkles, I love this guy. He's hilarious. But by today's standards, what Girard does next is not cute and is quite debatable in terms of his character. And I mean, we'll even see his own team dispute his methods. He goes from being a good law enforcer to one of still scary, still formidable, but one that I'm not sure is completely innocent. Because, yeah, they play the old Mrs. Lippman game from Silence of the Lambs. We think they've found Harrison Ford. He was seen with a woman And the last shot we had had of Harrison Ford, he had dyed his hair in a gas station and gone off with some lonely lady pulled over and picked him up as a hitchhiker. So, oh God, they're on to him and they're closing in on this house. Nope, you've forgotten about Copeland. At least that's what they're hoping. And when the new guy is, you know, being held captive, Sam Gerard has no qualms about sneaking up behind him and just shooting him without warning, without any kind of negotiation. Killing in cold blood.
You think that's a dodgy move? Because there was a gun to Noah's head, and Noah's life was very much in danger. This is a Hollywood trope, of course, but it is also guaranteeing, theoretically, the safety of one of your agents versus trying to negotiate with a crazed gunman.
Yeah, I definitely think that this is very debatable in today's climate about police brutality, for sure, 100%.
Okay, all right. I'm hearing that. And it also gives the moment of, I don't bargain, right? So it does give the ruthlessness of this man, but at the same time, a likable person. But I kind of like the scene. I think it works really well with the breaking down doors. An unexpected action beat at this moment.
But even Newman, the man being held hostage, is like, I don't agree with this. I mean, again, he's the new guy on the team. He was the one sitting around that Gerard made go get the sprinkled donuts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's got to be wondering what is his boss capable of. And it just gives a darker shading to all of this. That's all I'm really saying. I'm not saying it turns me against Sam Gerard. It just means that he's kind of ruthless. And yeah, will he do that to Kimball if given the opportunity?
Yes, he did. In fact, we'll see that coming up soon, that he will take a shot at Kimball if he has the opportunity.
But now the movie's going to slow down. And that's unfortunate because I know you say you can't keep this up for 2 hours, Stuart. I respectfully disagree and think that some Michael Bay movies do keep the adrenaline going for 2 hours, some to better effect than others.
Stop.
And they're not good movies, Arnie. They're hard to watch.
We haven't watched one yet. That's all I gotta say. We haven't watched a good one yet, but yeah. I haven't seen them all.
And others. I think that Con Air kept it going pretty much the whole time, the adrenaline, the action.
We're not talking about sustaining adrenaline. You obviously want to do that in a thriller. We're talking about changing the focus from we gotta hunt this guy to solving the murder. Like, whodunit? That's what this is.
Yes, Richard Kimball is solving the whodunit. He's trying to solve this thing, and we see him doing different, like the TV show would do, like different instances of him impacting people's lives for the better as he is trying to save his own life. And interspersed with that, we have the scene like when Kimball calls his lawyer and the marshals get it, and they start talking about, I want to hear the sound of an elevated train. And they figure out he's back in Chicago. There's the cat and mouse, but not literally cat and mouse. It's these guys are solving their puzzle. Where is Kimball? Whereas Kimball's trying another one. So there's two different mysteries going on at all times, and I'm kind of into it. You guys say it slows down. The pacing slows down from like a chase, literal chase scene. We'll get a couple of those later on soon. But when they're trying to figure out their different quests, I'm completely involved with how Kimball is trying to solve what he's doing and what he's doing with making IDs and going to the hospital, and Gerard trying to figure out where exactly Kimball's going to go next.
Let me dissent then. I find Kimball's search for the one-armed man to be functional, but not good. You know, it is a perfectly suitable MacGuffin for him to be chasing after. It's fine. However, were it not for the other stuff in this movie, I wouldn't call it The Fugitive, I'd call it The Forgettable. You know, really, this entire one-armed man pharmaceutical company, my doctor friend is my doctor killer type stuff, I don't care for it. And if that were just the whole movie, if it were just this part of Kimball doing his investigation where he knows hospitals and is able to break into prosthetic clinics and use their computer systems, I will object. Doctors do not know how to use computer systems in hospitals. Having worked in hospitals, I can say this with authority, but his hospital knowledge allows him to track it down.
The fact that he knows how to use the janitor's cart is like questionable. Yeah, I agree. Yes. Doctors, can he turn on the light? Like, I agree. I've worked in hospitals in menial capacity and been really surprised. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah, the doctors have a support team for a reason, and but that he's going to be doing this to find the number of patients who have missing right arms and at the mid bicep and needed a repair around the time of the death of Kimball's wife because he pulled off the prosthetic from the one-armed man's arm. It's functional, but it is somewhat disinteresting.
I disagree.
Yeah, I'll disagree on that, and I'll agree with you later. The climax of this movie is not satisfying.
Yes.
Who ends up doing it and why is an afterthought that 30 screenwriters threw a bunch of ideas into a bag, shook it, and picked out three.
Yeah, it's shake and bake. Completely agree.
I agree with that. But up until this point, the act two is, I mean, this stuff's really important. In part, this is where I'm going to compliment Harrison Ford. He makes us care about Kimball's cunning. Sam Gerard is smart in the way that he's able to isolate sounds on a recording and close in on the man that he's assigned to catch. But Kimball is just as smart. And, you know, where do you go? You have to hide, for one thing, and you have to prove your innocence. And by this point, it's been 100% confirmed. He keeps going to sleep, and we replay the murder, and now he can see that there is this other individual. We don't recognize who that individual is. They don't have fingerprints or anything, but we definitely know Kimball is innocent, and all he's got to go on is amputee. I like the fact that he goes about Cook County Hospital records and all of that stuff is, yeah, I mean, it gives him something really smart to do that seems plausible and, again, makes me like Harrison Ford.
It's plausible and it's implausible at the same time because it looks like the cops had just a hard-on to get him convicted versus actually doing their homework about one-armed man. Like, if Kimball can figure this out so quickly, why couldn't the policeman?
Well, because they didn't believe him because right. It does sound right. A little crazy that there was a one-armed man.
Right, yes, that sounds like a lie. And again, in the culture, even in 1993, which hasn't even become the what I would call the true crime culture of now, where, like, you know, people are just obsessed with real life murders of spouses.
The following year, Stewart, was O.J. Simpson. That's when it really started.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, we're on the dawn of this. But even then, I can believe, again, sort of the characterization of law enforcement is a lot of them are lazy. Sam Gerard is the exception. Most of them are like, husband did it. Let's call it a day. Let's go home. That's what I'm getting the sense of. So again, you have two men that care really passionately about their job. And yeah, it's kind of, it's nice symmetry. They're nicely paired that Harrison Ford has something as interesting to do as Tommy Lee Jones.
So while he's doing this, Kimball inserts himself in a hospital and decides to help a kid out. He's, you know, Julianne Moore plays a doctor, and Julianne Moore is the beginning of her career. At this point, she actually was going to have a whole subplot with Richard Kimball, which I heard different stories of when I was doing research. Either they did film it and they cut it, or they decided it wasn't appropriate and they said, sorry, Julianne, we're going to cut these scenes. You were promised a bigger part, but we're not going to film it.
Were they going to have a love affair? Because that would be spicy with his wife just that barely corpse being cold.
Yeah, they exactly why they cut it. Same thing with Jane Lynch's character. They were going to have a hint about him having an affair with her. I'm not kidding. They have all these different aspects of Kimball getting some.
Yeah, okay. That's funny.
And they decide you got to keep him away from the women because he's trying to investigate the killer of his wife.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad they chose not to include those. That said, I got to think it's been, what, 15 months since his wife died?
Or three. I mean, we're, again, that nebulous timeline of, like, is this happening incredibly fast or are they just skipping over a lot of boring?
Yeah, I agree.
But I'm glad they didn't include that stuff, even though it is weird to see Julianne Moore in such a small role.
Well, again, she was coming from soap operas.
And she's highly credited. She's, like, pretty high up in the names on the credits. I saw her in the credits. I'm like, what role does she have? None.
Right, yeah, because they cut her stuff out. It's happens. I can name a few other movies that happens. But after this was 9 months, right, was her a big break for her, too, with Hugh Grant. That was in 95, I believe. And then Big Lebowski and Spielberg and Lost World, etc.
Shortcuts was the same year.
Oh, there you go. So Kimball looks at an X-ray, saves his kid's life. When Gerard gets there, when she calls the cops, and there's a really great moment when she says he saved this boy's life, and they're all curious on why he's doing that. And then, of course, there's a great moment when he and Joey Pants see an amputee walking through the hospital, and they follow him, and they lurch their heads at the same time, and they realize what Kimball is doing. So they're on to Kimball, and Kimball has no idea. And it's just, I love it when the antagonist, and Stewart has already said this, and I want to reiterate, this is a moment where they prove it to you. The antagonist is smart. Movie dumb is so annoying. When people in movies make bad decisions or just, like, throw logic out the window, and this movie will have a little bit of that later. But in this second act, everyone is so brilliant and so smart and is really doing what you wish you would do at that moment. And it's really nice to see people being so capable and not making stupid mistakes. It's great. that's the kind of movie that you wish, even though this movie was written on the fly, it seems, according to everything we're reading, it seems to me that the care was there for that kind of characterizations.
Well, they've had a lucky break. It should be said the reason why they're even able to find their suspect at Cook County is the fact that he rented a room from a criminal. That in order to hide out, he went to this Polish woman whose son is apparently a drug dealer selling to underage girls. And we have a funny scene where the police are raiding the place and Kibble doesn't realize they're not coming for him. They came for his landlord, who, once he figures out, is renting to Kimball, is happy to rat his tenant out. They've gone to the apartment and seen all the supplies that he took from the hospital. They know he's impersonating a janitor. So skillful editing. I want to just say that in parsing this out, we aren't capturing the full joy of the intercut in the way that we go back and forth between pursuer and investigator.
I also quote a line here, says, whenever we eat oranges in the house, eating oranges and making IDs. And I just love it. And then he says the name and the Hispanic name on the tag. And it's just a moment of they're serious and they find a place to put levity in. Another great moment for Gerard. And so Kimball tracks down the list of five names and he calls people about high school reunions or blah, blah, blah. He finds all these reasons to cold call these people. And that's a kind of fun scene to watch, as well as Tommy Lee.
To be clear, these are five names of amputees who would have the prosthetic that he pulled off the attacker, right? Like that.
Yes.
He knew something about the actual mechanics of that arm. And so that's what allows him to narrow that field down to five in all of Chicago.
And as he does that, Tommy Lee is figuring out what he is doing. And so they converge at the middle as Kimball goes to the prison in the middle of Chicago to talk to a guy who may be who he's looking for. And they have the great city hall scene.
You know, it's sad, like if this were a couple years later, the computer records would have probably a photo of the patient in it, and he would know right away, not my guy. He could figure it out right there at the console, which one was the one-armed man that he needed, but he has to go look. That's the problem of a pre-internet age, folks, is that, he has to actually risk going through security and all the, you know, headaches to go into a prison, ironically, to see if this is his one-armed man. And within seconds, nope, it's not. He's got to go now.
Mm-hmm.
But running out of that room straight into Gerard.
Which is a great scene. They kind of do that fake out, the Silence of the Lambs house fake out again, because Gerard has decided the elevator's taking too long. He's taking the stairs. You talk about Tommy Lee Jones' fitness. This is a lot of flights that Tommy Lee Jones mm-hmm. is going up. And we see Harrison Ford going down the other set of stairs. You think it's the same set of stairs. You think they're going to pass each other. And then you see a scene where there's two sets of stairs, one at each end of the building. But Gerard does get just a glimpse, knows enough to go after, shout Richard. Harrison Ford looks up and the chase is again afoot. And I'm again excited. This is good stuff.
How smart is him of Gerard to say Richard, to make him stop? That's so smart. And then at the climax, when he's running out of the building, limping again because he's hurt, he says, "Officer, officer, there's a man in a top coat waving a gun and shouting." And then the policemen stop him, stop Gerard. And they're both so smart.
And lucky. I mean, don't discount the fact that Gerard's a good shot. Good thing that it's bulletproof glass. You got to love the moment with Harrison Ford's foot stuck in the door. He should be a dead man, but because it's jail, they have bulletproof glass up, and he's actually protected from the law at that moment. But you're right, he would have killed him right there.
Yeah, he absolutely would have killed him. There's another moment I was talking about. And then they sneak into the St. Patrick's Day Parade, which they actually filmed that year, 1993.
I do love the line, you know, just banter among the U.S. Marshals that you're talking about, Brock. They can mm-hmm. dye the river green on this day. Why can't they dye it blue the other 364 days?
Yeah, that's an old Chicago joke. I lived in Chicago. Everyone makes that joke.
I live in Chicago currently, and I make that joke every year. Every year. Every time I see a picture of the river, every time I walk by it, it's you have to say it because it's funny. That's where the hinky thing comes in as well. So they got permission to film in the actual St. Patrick's Day parade, and they had to get Harrison Ford, the unions had to be contacted. It was a big mess. But funny enough, Tommy Lee Jones recognized more than Harrison Ford. Apparently, since Harrison Ford found that hat in the garbage, which was not planned, and taking off his quote and all that, people didn't realize it was Ford, but they realized that the cameras are on Tommy Lee Jones. And so talk about clever editing, Stuart. The amount of footage we got of them in the parade without people noticing them is all because of the editing.
Mm-hmm.
They had to piece together so many little parts to make sure that people didn't spoil their shots. And I didn't notice one person spoiling the shots at all. It's a lot of fun how he gets lost in a parade and Tommy Lee Jones is flabbergasted. And it's a great climax, a great button to that scene right there in the middle of the movie.
Yeah, I love seeing Tommy Lee Jones jumping, you know, trying to look over people. He's jumping up and down. It's fun.
Yeah, and another reason why Chicago loves Andrew Davis and lets him film there is because he really shows off part of the city that, you know, doesn't always get seen. But, like, you know, maybe people outside of Illinois know what a big deal the St. Patrick's Day parade is. But now you get to say you were there because you watched The Fugitive, and that's cool.
Yeah. So Kimball finds Sykes, goes to the house, calls Gerard. Great scene there.
Sykes being the one-armed man. Let's spell that out in case you don't remember all the names I dropped in the plot summary.
Fair enough. And my mistake. Yes. So here's where the movie starts to get confusing. And I've seen this movie, I can't tell you how many times. And this is the place where on the way home from the theater, my girlfriend and I had the most epic fight we've ever had because she couldn't understand how Lentz was part of this conspiracy. Who is Lentz? Why is Lentz important? We don't even get to meet really Lentz at all.
Mm-mm. He was there at the Four Seasons. The guy returning the keys was like, here, meet Lentz.
Yes. Yeah.
They put a button on it, but yeah, it's very thin. And yeah, let's just walk through all of this.
Yes, let's do it right now.
I think it would be helpful to try and understand what happened to Helen. Because even in your plot summary, Arnie, I heard you say, why? And I got my own questions, but I think I know that part. What we know is that there was drug testing of something called Provasic, which was meant to help with abdominal issues?
No, clear your arteries, make vascular surgery a thing of the past. So it's all heart related. That's why Kimball was involved at all.
Okay. Well, maybe this is or isn't important. The night of the murder, Kimball is called to the ER because Lentz was patient. And they said his abdomen was causing this man's problem. And Lentz wasn't picking up the phone. So this was somebody that Lentz was supposed to be attending to, and Kimball got called in. This is all a setup. Lentz is in cahoots with the one-armed man with, we'll go ahead and spoil it. We haven't really talked about it, but Jerome Krabbe is playing Dr. Nichols, the guy that had borrowed the car keys. They all want Harrison Ford to be in the ER so they can attack his wife and frame Harrison Ford for that crime.
No, I disagree. No. I think what happened here is that, and in fact, they say that the one-armed man was sent there to kill Richard Kimball.
What?
They want to kill Richard Kimball because he had discovered this Provasic was causing liver damage to people.
But they knew where he was. He was attending to Lentz's patient. So that's, again, Lentz knew.
No. Lentz may or may not have been in on it, but Arnie's right. The one-armed man was there to kill Kimball because Kimball was going to blow the lid off the whole thing. He wasn't home because he was called away. So the guy was already there. He was going to kill Helen, and then he was going to wait for Richard to get home. Richard did come home, but he could not succeed killing Richard as well. So he ran away because he was overpowered by Richard.
So he killed Richard's wife just to get time, just so that he could sit around the house and not be bothered. That's the whole reason.
And he did so in a way that with leaving no incriminating evidence that he is the one that did it. That would take some planning, I would think. Now, I know one of his hands doesn't have fingerprints, but the other one does. And again, like what we'll hear is that the cops, who are not in on it, found no evidence of an intruder.
They said no forced entry. My guess was when he borrowed the car keys, he let the one-armed man in the house. The one-armed man was waiting there. And Kimball wasn't home.
That explains the car borrowing, because I know that the car borrowing comes up later on. They're going to say that there's a record where the one-armed man was called from Kimball's car phone. And we find out that it was this Dr. Nichols, because Nichols borrowed the car and Nichols knew the one-armed man. But I didn't understand why Nichols needed the car. He needed the car to get the house key so that there wouldn't be a forced entry.
Right. Exactly.
I've got a un-PC question to ask If you were hiring an assassin, why go with the one-armed guy? Why did they pick Sykes?
Because he's willing to do the work, I think, is really the answer. Like, one-armed man is just something that's notable for Kimball to claim, right? Because it's helpful for him to find the guy.
I don't want to disparage people that are missing limbs, but wouldn't you want it seems like a very identifiable thing, right? Like, you wouldn't want that to be...
No, I get that.
This guy already works for the pharmaceutical company, though. He is their in-house goon. He is listed as like one of the higher ups in security and protecting the CEOs.
And he used to be a cop.
Yeah, he used to be a cop who's gone into private security for the pharmaceutical company. They're not just going to Guns and Ammo and placing an ad, Hitman Wanted. They're going with somebody who they know.
Exactly. And he's willing to do it, which is, I mean, I'm not a criminal mastermind, as we've already heard on this podcast today. However, I do know that I want a guy who's willing to do it. If I'm going to kill somebody.
Yes. And benefits like being able to take fishing trips to Mexico with Lentz, who wouldn't kill a wife or two?
And let me just put out there, in the past 30 years, I believe this movie has only been proven right. I absolutely believe a pharmaceutical company would have their head of security kill a doctor if it meant their patent gets approved.
Yeah, Big Pharma is like the villain that keeps on giving, isn't it? For all these kinds of movies. My issue here still is Lentz, because it's not entirely clear if he was in on it or not.
I believe he wasn't.
He is.
Lentz was not in on it. Because he also gets killed in a car accident, and after he's killed, the slides get replaced. The liver slides showing the damage.
Mm-mm. No, the day that he dies is the day that he signs off on it.
Which implies that those were forged.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
It's messy. I'm not going to deny it's not messy.
Maybe. Or now you're no longer useful to us because you signed off on these good livers being the ones when it wasn't.
Right. Tying up loose ends.
Either way. Yeah. It could go either way. Maybe right. It doesn't even matter if Lentz is involved or not. He's helpfully not someone that Harrison Ford or Gerard are going to have to chase down. He's already been killed the previous year.
Yeah, that's an easy thing for the story.
If he was killed the previous year, then we know a year has passed since the trial.
True.
Oh, yeah. There you go. There's one mystery solved.
Okay.
We worked together. We got that together. All right. There we go. But also, it's helpful that we have one less person that we have to worry about. Killing him off that way also adds that extra air of conspiracy going on. It makes sense that they killed him off, but it's very confusing.
Yeah, and I want to just add, yes, of course, pharmaceutical companies are an easy bad guy, but they're not really behind it. What we will find out is the doctor who wanted to benefit from their stocks is the one behind it. And since he had access to the drug trials, he can manipulate that. And because that would be, I mean, that would be more than one person, right? Like the chasing down a board of the, you know, pharmaceutical company. Like, you're not done just grabbing one guy from a convention like they're going to do in this climax. They simplify it so that we can just have one bad doctor that Kimball already knows and thinks is a friend.
But now you've just brought up more questions. Like, how does this one bad doctor know the head of security at the pharmaceutical company, you know? So if nobody at the pharmaceutical company was involved, then we have more hoops that are not jumped through in this plot.
Well, we hear that this doctor is in bed with that pharmaceutical company, so maybe he goes to their shindigs and talks to their security detail. Does it matter to enjoy the movie? I guess I'll just put it out there. I'm going to say I find this resolution to who killed Helen to be kind of a lot of hooey and not really important in my entertainment of the movie. It's not about the whodunit for me.
Right. So the TV show was all about Kimball finding the one-armed man who killed his wife. In this movie, they decided the one-armed man is not enough. There has to be something behind the reason Kimball's wife got killed. The TV show didn't have a reason. It was just a break-in gone bad.
Oh my God. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know? So here they decided they really needed a reason for the break-in, quote-unquote, gone bad. And they did this.
My problem with this ending is I like the one-armed man here. I think Sykes is imposing enough, and the scene on the L train with Sykes and Kimball, where Sykes is trying to finally kill Kimball, and there's a transit cop who's alerted because there's the funny scene of the guy reading the newspaper that actually has Kimball's face on the front page.
Wait a second. The transit cop, Neil Flynn. You recognize Neil Flynn, right? From Scrubs?
Yeah, the janitor from Scrubs.
The janitor. And there's a really funny episode of Scrubs late in their run where JD and Turk think that the janitor is that guy in The Fugitive. And the janitor, of course, won't confirm or deny it's him. And that's kind of fun. They played that.
But then at the end, they do confirm it's him. So yeah. Yes, in that world, the guy who played that role did not succeed in Hollywood and instead became a janitor.
Right.
Which is perhaps a more true story for most Hollywood actors than you get a regular role on a sitcom in primetime that goes on for years. But I like Sykes, but when you get to the big bad and it's this Dr. Nichols who we've seen pop up. I mean, if you're thinking script and you're thinking, why is this character showing up? Obviously, he's the bad guy, because there's no reason to have this character keep popping up. Kimball stopped mm-hmm. his car outside his tennis club and said, I need some money. And then we got to see Gerard go and interrogate Nichols a couple of times. But Nichols is a shitty big bad. He is not the one you want to see Harrison Ford getting in the fist fight with at the end. Maybe Tommy Lee Jones would be better in a fist fight, but this Nichols guy, he is just a weak villain for this movie.
I don't really want to watch two 45-year-old men duke it out who don't know how to fight. That's for sure. They fight all over this hotel.
I mean, just understand what I think you're saying. You're wanting a physical climax, and you want someone that is muscular or threatening.
No, they're giving us a physical climax that makes no sense with this Dr. Nichols. They're going to be punching it out, and I just don't think that this actor and this character are right for this big reveal. I think it might have been better if it wasn't a mystery, where this no-name character that we don't pay attention to the first time we watch this movie is the bad guy, means that at the end, it means nothing that he's the bad guy. If we knew he was the bad guy all along, maybe that would help this reveal or this climax to feel like he's a worthy bad guy for both Gerard and Kimball to be chasing around this hotel.
Maybe. Here's what I'll offer that he gives us. We have two people, as you're saying, that Kimball has to bring to justice. He goes on the L train and gets to arrest, handcuff the one-armed man on his good arm. So, like, he's brought him literally to justice, almost as good as dragging him into the police station and saying, here's the guy. But if this is the man who was, like, he thought was a friend and is, like, at a conference, like, getting awards, giving the keynote speech, you want to see someone like that humiliated in front of his peers. So to have Harrison Ford be able to walk in to that convention, grab the mic, and call him out in front of everybody. I mean, you hear it. Everyone knows it's Kimball. They're not arresting him. They want to hear the tea, you know, like, they want to see what is going on between these two. And there's just satisfaction in being able to call this kind of villain to the carpet publicly. Embarrassing.
I agree with that. I don't like the fight in the laundromat, but I agree with that moment. I also enjoyed that it gives us a chance to have the second Harrison Ford angry pointing scene. It was really early in the movie. You get a second one here. If you're a Harrison Ford fan, you always look for the pointing scene. And we get two of them in this one. The climax in the laundromat is, you know, when Gerard talks to Kimball saying, we know that he did it, and he explains the whole thing out loud so Kimball knows that he's not going back to jail, and then he saves Gerard's life. All of that is, saving the life part is fine. It's the whole, these two guys who have no idea how to throw down, these two nerds are fighting, these two doctors are fighting. Yeah. It's not exciting to watch, and it's not a great climax.
Agreed.
This is what I'm saying, yes.
Well, one little fix that they could have done. So he walks in, he humiliates him, and yay, they should be dragging him away, except the Chicago PD is looking for a cop killer. On the subway, when Kimball was arresting that one-armed man, the one-armed man shot a cop, but PD didn't know that. They've added to the list of crimes that Kimball is wanted for that he has killed one of their own and are just bloodthirsty. When they get up to the roof, it's really the PD, the Chicago PD, that Kimball has to worry about. Like, that's who's going to kill him. Would that have been enough? Like, okay, so they're not fighting each other, but cops are busting in here still trying to kill Kimball? Would that be a fix?
I think that would be if now Gerard is the hero, and it would undercut Harrison Ford as a heroic person. Because it's a Harrison Ford movie, you want to see Harrison Ford punch somebody at the end, I think, even if it's punching them off their airplane. So I feel like if you weren't worried about undermining the heroicness of our main protagonist, then yes, that would work. But the way you describe it, the only solution would be for him to run into the saving arms of Tommy Lee Jones, and that would not be a satisfying ending.
Okay. My problems are a little bit more cosmetic. I will just go ahead and offer that the Chicago Hilton is historic. It was where the Democratic Convention was in 68 and all the riots. If you know that history, big deal. But it's an ugly hotel, and it's just not giving you the kind of set pieces for a climax. Like, apparently, there's a glass ceiling that they fall into a service elevator or something and end up in a laundry room. I agree. Like, these aren't things that are nice to look at. For a Chicago director that knows the town and knows how to feature its best assets, this is just not the hotel you want to shoot in for any climax.
I hear what you're saying, but I see why they made the choice. It's a very historic hotel. You could also just have the outside of it and then just interiors don't have to be there. They can film it anywhere.
It's just not a great looking hotel. I mean, again, my school used to be like right next door. We shot student films all over that thing. I know from experience, not a great place to photograph. It just doesn't come off well on film. And yeah, I think for me, you just want something big, right? If we've had trains and all of that jumping off the dam, you got to go one bigger for the final one. And seeing, yeah, middle-aged men pushing around laundry carts at each other, that ain't it.
Yeah.
All right, so then Gerard is saved by Kimball, and Arnie mentioned the scene. I thought you don't care. Well, don't tell anybody. You see the one-armed man go into a police car, and we're left to believe that Kimball will be exonerated, and all will be right in the world. The bad people are going to jail, and the right person's being set free. That is where the movie ends. So, Stuart, Arnie, do you recommend The Fugitive? Stuart.
Yeah, I recommend it. It's not a great movie, meaning I don't feel like it's going to take you on an experience that is unique. It's a fun ride. Like, if you just enjoy the movies as entertainment, kind of turn off your brain idea. Yeah, but maybe don't pay attention to the whodunit part and just ride the fact that this is two really cool actors who don't have a lot of screen time with each other. But again, the way that each plays, it's kind of like they're each doing their own monologue and occasionally come together. It's just really exciting to see that star power and that cunning and that who's going to outsmart who. Like watching like chess or something like that. I know that's a very intellectual thing, but imagine that if that were a Hollywood ride. That's kind of my experience watching this movie. I just really appreciate watching Kimball solve his wrongful arrest as Gerard figures out how Kimball has escaped every other authority. And yeah, watching those grains of sand run out of the hourglass to a pretty mediocre finale. Again, it does run out of steam. I think that's part of the problem, is the movie ends at the weakest moment in its entire run. It's a pretty solid, fun thrill ride up until the last 10-15 minutes, and then it's kind of meh. But yeah, it didn't have to be Harrison Ford. Kind of wish I could see it with a different actor, but it's another feather in his fedora. He has, up to this point, had more than a decade of really classic characters and box office hits. And this is one to be proud of. And yeah, it makes me excited for his Indiana Jones finale this Friday. So solid recommend.
Arnie.
He made a great movie 30 years ago. Let's hope this Friday he does again, finally. That's what I hear in Stuart's recommend.
I didn't say great. In fact, I said it wasn't a great movie. I said it was a great ride.
No, but you said it gave you hope for the fifth Indiana Jones film. I'm like, there's a lot of films that came in between these two.
Yeah, no, I'm not hopeful. If you really want to know, I'm not expecting this new one to be maybe slightly better than Crystal Skull. That's what I'm hoping for.
Oof. Low bar.
Yeah, seriously.
But as for my final thought on The Fugitive, I agree with what Stuart said. The problem with this film is that it peaks early. The train and the chase after the train is absolutely, in my mind, the best part of this film. And it's mostly in the first 30-45 minutes. And then you're left with a average movie. The first 30-45 minutes of this film are really, really good. I like the intercutting of the way that we see the murder with the trial. I like the prison break. I like the train crash, even though there's a little dodgy effects. I still love the train crash. And then I really love when Tommy Lee Jones comes on the scene and owns the screen. All of that at the beginning. If this movie went to total shit at the 45-minute mark, I'd still be giving it a recommend for that first 45 minutes. It's that good. And fortunately, the movie doesn't go to shit, but it really stumbles and when we finally figure out, and it took three of us to suss out the plot, and one of us has seen this film so many times, and it still took the three of us to all try to figure out who the one-armed man was and how that related to Nichols and that other doctor and the Provasic. Where does Devlin McGregor fit into all of this? It's a bit of a mess, and the ending is not as exciting as it should be given the film that it's coming after. It's a solid recommend from me, but kind of at the time, when people consider this a all-time classic, one of Harrison Ford's best, when you said at the very top of this podcast, Brock, it goes Indiana Jones, Star Wars, The Fugitive. I'm like, really? There's a lot of better Harrison Ford films out there, but this one's good. And a recommend.
I would say Blade Runner before The Fugitive, right? That's a classic Harrison Ford movie. And no, there's not many. There's a lot of movies I like of Harrison Ford's, but this one is like the fourth one I think of all the time of Harrison Ford. Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Blade Runner, The Fugitive.
I'm going to give a shout out to Witness.
I literally think of Witness before I think of this.
Yeah, Witness. Yeah, Witness deserves to be up there, higher.
I think Witness is a very good movie and I enjoy it, but I don't come back to watch that movie very often. I come back to The Fugitive. I own The Fugitive on numerous formats over the years because I don't watch movies over and over again like I used to when I was younger. But when I was doing that, The Fugitive was on frequent watch for me. Obviously, this is a recommend for me. I'm a fan of this movie. I do think it's a great movie. I completely agree that the end of this movie and the ramifications and blah, 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 Devlin McGregor, blah, blah, all that crap at the end is so confusing. It's certainly confusing. It's unnecessarily confusing. And Arnie has a good point. The movie does seem to peak pretty early on. However, I do really like all of the scenes with Gerard investigating, with Kimball investigating. I think the time the movie really falls apart for me is the last 20 minutes. The rest of it, I'm still into it. I really enjoy the characters. And watching it over and over again over the years, then revisiting it for this podcast today and sharing it with my daughter. Another movie I watched with my daughter introduced her to this. It was really fun in that aspect to show her something like this. We don't get to watch a lot of movies like this together yet because she's, you know, not there yet. So it's kind of fun for me as a father to share it with her and just enjoy what I was watching. The fact of the matter is this movie is really enjoyable to watch. And yes, the movie falls apart a little bit at the end, but I still think it's a great movie. I really enjoy watching it. I highly recommend you all check it out. And I do think it is a classic Harrison Ford movie that I'm surprised you two are more down on it. But I do think 30 years later, it still works, and it's a great ride.
I don't mean to seem down on it, but, you know, when you drop the ball at the end, that hurts. You know, if you have a strong beginning and you finish kind of sluggish, this movie does that. I think what would have helped, you know what we really wanted to see? Who cares who did it and the pharmaceutical whatever? But I just wanted Tommy Lee Jones and Harrison Ford to work together. They've been at opposition for so much in the film. To have them come together and actually catch the guy, that was what I was looking for. And it just doesn't happen. But it's a movie supported by star power. I mean, honestly, good old-fashioned star power pulls this thing through all of its plot problems. And yeah, I like it. I want to be clear. I like this film.
Yeah, I also want to disagree with saying I'm down on this movie. I praised the first 45 minutes endlessly. And then, yeah, it has problems after that.
Overrated.
But here, clearly, I said solid recommend. And yes, overrated is a very good word.
All right.
Yeah, it didn't deserve to be up for Best Picture. I agree. But I hear you enjoying it. I hear you wanting to share it. We're still watching it 30 years later, and despite some blue screen effects, mostly holds up.
Yeah, you know, I told some people around town that I'm watching this movie. A lot of us are having these conversations about when do we share movies we love with our kids, and how in the past when we shared like The Princess Bride or Star Wars with our kids too early when they're not ready for it, and how they didn't really care. And when I brought up this one to the parents of my daughter's friends, their eyes lit up like, oh, that's a great idea. Because a lot of us who are this age, you guys, maybe it was overrated but it's a bit forgotten nowadays. I don't really think people think about The Fugitive besides people like me who, you know, it's one of their favorite movies of back in the day. You know what I mean? So the fact that so many people gave me a reaction of, oh, that's a great idea, I'm going to do that with my family soon, or I forgot that movie existed, or I never got a chance to see that one, or it was a conversation piece for the last couple of weeks around here that people were actually interested in talking about and they haven't thought about for a long time. So maybe that's the same case with our audience. Some of you probably have never seen this movie or heard of it before because of whatever reasons. But for those of you who saw it way back when and haven't seen it in a long time, it's kind of one of those movies that, oh yeah, I will check that out.
You know what I want to talk about?
What's that?
This thing had a sequel and I don't know anyone that ever saw it.
I saw it in theaters opening weekend, surprisingly.
I saw it in theaters, too.
Oh, okay. Well, I know two people that did, but they never told me anything about it. Fugitive, Best Picture nominee, huge cultural moment. And yeah, 5 years later, Wesley Snipes ran around, apparently. And Tommy Lee Jones eventually catches him. We'll see. I don't know anything about U.S. Marshals, but I really do kind of want to know, how do you continue on without Harrison Ford? If he was so much a part of the star power... To lose him, I don't know. I'm very curious to see how you do it all over again.
I have an answer for you, but I'm looking forward to telling you that answer on the next podcast. A little cliffhanger for our listeners to come back and hear our U.S. Marshals podcast.
And in the meantime, we've got a patron review coming out this Friday for our monthly patrons on Patreon or Podbean. $10 or more, you get the bonus film every month. We're doing the July film one day early. I mean, Friday's June 30th. We figured, you know, you guys can give us a pass on that one so that we can give you guys a review of Steven Spielberg's Indiana Jones wannabe film, the animated Tintin.
Yep, we could have done a lot of things, but when I realized that this is the weekend that Indy comes out, Indy 5, Dial of Destiny... I wanted to, you know, reflect on the fact that Spielberg's not making that film, but he did make a film kind of like it. Crystal Skull wasn't his last swashbuckler. We're going to talk about how Tintin turned out and who the hell Tintin is if you're an American. All of that gets explained this Friday.
I'm looking forward to that. I had seen that movie too, although I did not see it in the theater. And I had vague recollections of a character named Tintin because we had a Danish family living down the block when I was a kid, and they had the comic books. And they also had Asterix, who's also a very famous cartoon character across the world who's not known really well in America.
They will be discussed.
I haven't seen the film yet, but I only have seen the cover. I'm assuming Tintin is the dog, like Rin-Tin-Tin?
No, he's the kid with the something about Mary hair sticking up.
Oh, it's not about a dog?
It's about a dog. It definitely is about a dog, but...
There's a dog there for sure.
Join us this Friday to find out all about you silly Americans, what we've been missing for 50 years, and Spielberg's last swashbuckler.
And please come back next week to hear our review of U.S. Marshals. And I want to remind you all, it's not bad for government work.
All right, can we go home now?
No! No!
Where'd they go? Where'd they go?
Thank you for listening to this Now Playing Podcast movie review.
Thanks, Doctor.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed the show.
I'm not having any fun here. You know how cranky I get when I don't have any fun.
Yeah, we know, we know.
And come back to NowPlayingPodcast.com next Tuesday for another all-new movie review podcast.
It's not over yet.
Help us spread the word about this show by leaving a 5-star review on Stitcher, iTunes, or your podcast store of choice.
I hate involving you in this, but baby, I got nobody else I can trust.
Want more reviews like this one? In the archives section of NowPlayingPodcast.com, you'll find more than 1,000 in-depth movie reviews from our panel of hosts.
Excellent work, young man.
Support from listeners like you keeps Now Playing Podcast on the air.
Financially, you're not going to be hurting after this then, are you?
You can donate directly by tapping the support button at NowPlayingPodcast.com.
I need some money.
Sure, sure.
Just whatever you got on you.
Need more Now Playing? Subscribe to our In Focus weekly newsletter for exclusive digital download giveaways, celebrity interviews, behind-the-scenes insights, and more. Sign up through the subscribe page on our website and get it delivered to your inbox every Friday.
Now you listen. Don't give a damn which way you go. Just don't follow me. You got that?
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
I thought we don't take our work personally.
We don't.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
I don't want to tell you how to do your job.
Now Playing is edited by Heath, Santiago, and Arnie.
Oh, well then you can explain the difference in the sound of an elevated train as opposed to a train that's running along the ground. You must have ears like an eagle.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
It's a hobby of mine.
It's a hobby, really?
Yeah.
What are your other hobbies? Brain surgery?
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Care to revise your statement, sir?
What? Do you want to change your bullshit story, sir?
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
And he was alone?
Yeah, he was alone.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
All right, fine. You want jurisdiction over this mess? You got it.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Hi, who's in charge?
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2023, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Come on, let's go.
Okay, I gotta go. Bye.
You know, including Wesley Snipes' Rising Son, you know, who will inherit the franchise next time.
Indeed. I just recently watched that one, actually.
I did see that one opening weekend.
Really? Wow. Okay, then.
I liked Wesley Snipes more than Harrison Ford.
Don't you know by now, Arnie, it's like a crapshoot. Who knows what draws Arnie to the certain projects? Everyone else is going to The Fugitive. Arnie's going to Rising Son.
Shut up.